Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, in season's greetings to you on this day after Christmas Day. I am Jim Behnke, and this is the December 26th, 2009 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, today we're going to stick with a family holiday theme and be joined very shortly by a father and son team that I'm sure you will not want to miss. I'll give you one hint. The father is one of a handful of people who has celebrated Christmas in space. Well, I hope you'll stick around for that and know that you are invited to join in the conversation anytime during the next hour by calling 768-1240. Star 1240 for the AT&T wireless customers along the Space Coast here. If you're out of town, the phone number, long distance, 321-768-1240. And, of course, if you're listening live online at WMMBAM.com, why don't you open up another screen and send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com, spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, last week there was a launch from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Another reliable Soyuz rocket and spacecraft blasted off into Earth orbit, this time with a Russian and a Japanese and an American on board. And on Tuesday, they docked to the International Space Station, joining the two others that were already there. There are now five people on board the station in orbit. Yesterday, they spent Christmas in space. I guess as has every space station crew that's been on board the outpost going back to 2000, it is kind of hard to believe that we're now into our 10th year of nonstop humans in space. But before the station, in fact, there were only three times that Americans spent Christmas in space. The first was the most famous, Apollo 8 in 1968. They were in lunar orbit, in fact, on Christmas Eve. Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders. If you remember the famous reading from the book of Genesis, which to this day still tugs at my heart when I listen to the recording. On Christmas Day, they fired their big service module engine to come home, and that's when Jim Lovell exclaimed famously to Houston, "Be advised, there is a Santa Claus." So if you needed proof, there it is right there from Lovell, the astronaut. He saw Santa from space. And the third time Americans were in space, we talked about the first. Now we're jumping ahead here to the third time Americans were in space at Christmas. That was in 1999 during one of the Hubble Space Telescope servicing missions. A very busy flight, not a lot of attention paid to the holiday itself, but the crew did find time, as I recall, to have some traditional holiday food, which I'm sure they spiced up with some hot sauce. I don't know if you've ever had turkey and Tabasco, but that's a favorite, believe it or not, of the astronauts. I should probably explain really quick that when astronauts get into space and all their fluids shift around inside their body, they basically shift up. Gravity's not holding all these fluids down in your legs. They go up in your body and they go up in your head, and it makes you feel like you have a head cold while you're in space. And of course, that, you know, anyone that knows what that has a head cold, you know that, you know, your taste gets dulled, the sense of taste gets dulled, and it's hard time to enjoy food. And so the astronauts are very famous for carrying all manners of spicy food and hot sauces and whatnot to put on their food and to make it tasty for them. And some of the combinations get pretty wild. But anyway, third time in space, astronauts in 1999. The second time that the astronauts were in space, backing up now in Christmas, and that's the particular time we're going to dwell on today, was in 1973 that three Apollo-era astronauts were on board the Skylab Orbital Workshop, our nation's first real space station. They spent Christmas of 1973 in orbit, and one of our guests was a member of the crew of that particular flight in 1973, the commander. And before we get to all that and we take a break here, and I want to just take a couple minutes and explain to you really quick, give you a little background on Skylab, because some of you may have actually never even heard of it. And some of you may just need to be a little refresher on it. I just thought I'd tell you a little bit about it. Skylab was thought up before the moon landing, the actual Apollo 11 moon landing in 69. There have been any number of ideas for space stations through the years. Wernher von Braun had come up with some concepts that were explored. The military were interested in their own manned orbiting laboratory, and all that kind of just was out there percolating. And they wanted to figure out a way to keep Apollo flying after the moon landings and find some other uses. In fact, there were some ideas for doing some science stuff at the moon, some ideas for doing some science stuff in Earth orbit. And as the budgets went away and things kind of settled, the dust settled, we wound up with this orbital laboratory that was going to lift off on board the top of a Saturn V. They took the third stage of a Saturn V rocket and basically emptied it, took one of the propellant tanks inside the third stage and made it into a little home, a little laboratory, an eating area, science area, a housing area, an exercise area. The other propellant tank inside the Skylab, they actually used as trash. And so there was the orbital workshop, and they launched it in May of 73. It was the last Saturn V flight from Kennedy Space Center. And right away there was a problem. Aerodynamic forces ripped off a meteorite protection shield, tore with it some of the power-generating solar array wing, and so it was in really bad shape, and it was a great rescue mission. Pete Conrad on the next Skylab launch, 11 days later, they launched with some hardware on board, figured out how to solve the problem, at least temporarily, and they stayed about 28 days in space. And then the next crew went up, and a little bit later in 1973, and stayed about 56 days in space, did some additional maintenance to the space station to fix the solar panel. They had some issues with that flight as well, but solved them all and set the stage for the third Skylab mission to launch. And, in fact, they went up with Commander Gerald Carr as the commander, and Mr. Carr was going to be joining us here shortly. And they were able to stay on board, I think it was 83 or 84 days in space, and to set the record that really held for quite some time in terms of long distance and long duration space flight. Did a lot of work, did a lot of neat things, and of course, as we're going to talk about here, actually remained in space for Christmas that year, and it's going to be an interesting story to hear about what it was like back then to do that. Skylab was a great piece of engineering, great piece of work that taught us a lot, gave us a lot of science, and there was hope going into the late 70s that the space shuttle program would come along and be ready to fly in time to send up some kind of a booster motor that would be able to be attached to the space station, to the Skylab, and send it into a higher orbit, because the orbit has slowly decayed through the years, and there was a risk we were going to lose it, and would they be able to save it and actually use it then for additional science. Unfortunately, delays in the shuttle program caused that to not happen, and famously, Skylab fell to Earth in 1979, burned up in Earth orbit, and scattered some amount of debris over parts of Australia. No one got hurt, no issues there, but again, it was quite the cultural phenomenon when Skylab was coming back in 79. So that's a little bit about that program, and coming up in just a moment then, what we're going to do is we're going to have the commander of that third and final Skylab mission, Colonel Jerry Carr, is going to be with us, as well as his son, Jeff Carr, who is now Director of Communications with United Space Alliance, and the two of them are going to be joining with us here in shortly to talk a little bit about that experience growing up in Houston, what it was like on the ground, what it was like in orbit. So it should be kind of fun. Remember that along the way here, you can join us in the conversation, 321-768-1240. Again, star 1240 for your local AT and wireless customers. Give us a call long distance, 321-768-1240. Send us email, spacetalking@AOL.com. And, of course, you can always follow us on Twitter. Space Talking is the username there as well. So in just a couple of minutes here, we're going to be joined by Jeff and Jerry Carr and talk Skylab and Christmas and the holidays and family. And we hope that you're going to stick along with us momentarily. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB. We'll be right back.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Chestnuts roasting on an open
fire. Welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Jack Frost. And 321-768-1240 is the number to call to join us today, a day in which we are thinking about the holidays and the families and the space program. And that's a good song. That leads us up nicely here. So, and with that in mind, we do have two guests on the phone with us today. One from Texas, the other, I think, from Vermont. We'll get corrected if that's wrong. But a father-son combo that represents two generations of space workers. And I'd like to start off by introducing the son, Jeff Carr, whom I will then give the honor in just a moment of introducing his father. You okay with that, Jeff?
That sounds great,
okay,
Jim.
Okay, good. Well, let me tell you who you are. Let me tell everyone who you are. Good. Well, let me tell you, if you wanted to create a family of true believers, of those who have a passion about the space program, the desire to share that story with others, then I am pleased to tell you that Jeff Carr and I are brothers in that family. I've known Jeff since he began working for NASA at the Johnson Space Center. In 1987, we have worked on many projects together, shared an adventure or two along the way, and he is now Director of Communications for United Space Alliance. And Jeff, formally, officially, welcome to Space Talk.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be on the air with a master space triviologist.
Yeah, let's not start any contests, shall we? Well, look, your dad is something special, too, and I know he's on the line with us. Would you take a moment and introduce him to us?
I sure will. First and foremost, I think of my dad as an officer and a gentleman and a great father, someone I've always looked up to and whose career in space inspired me and many others in my generation growing up in Clear Lake. And when you asked me a couple of weeks ago if I had any ideas for a Christmas-themed appearance for your radio show, the first thing I thought about was the day I spent at home listening to Air to Ground while my dad was walking in space. Wow. On Christmas in 1973. So I'm excited to introduce my dad, Jerry Carr.
Jerry, welcome aboard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good. Glad to have you. Are you in Vermont now? I mean, I know that's your phone number, but...
No, that's right. It's Vermont.
Are you cold and snowy up there?
Oh, you bet.
I can imagine. Well, we're warm and comfortable down here. I think the temperature's going to get all the way down to, I think, 50 tonight or maybe into the upper 40s. So.
Oh, poor babies.
We'll try to turn on the furnace for you or something. Well, look, we talked a little bit about Skylab in the first part of our show, but just give us the background as a commander who's been up there. Tell us what you think we ought to know about Skylab as a program, and maybe compare a little bit about how it compares to the International Space Station today.
Well, Skylab was America's first space station, and we built it out of spare parts. It was built out of equipment from the Apollo program. And the Skylab program was right at the tail end of the Apollo program in 1973. Mm-hmm. And 74. And we learned a lot from the Skylab program, and all of that information has been plowed into the design and the development of operations for the International Space Station that's up there right now.
Well, one of the things I'm intrigued by in talking to you on this is that, of course, you know, the Skylab essentially went up in one piece. And it was done. It was made. It was there. And, of course, there had to be some repairs. Pete Conrad and the gang, they had to do a lot of work by the time you got up there. It seemed to be a fairly stable platform.
Yes, right.
But you spent most of your time on science and not so much maintenance. And, of course, the history of the space station to date has been more assembly and maintenance than science. And I'm wondering, you know, is that a fair assessment, or what was your days spent like?
Well, I would say of the entire mission, probably 10 or 15% was on maintenance, and the rest of it was science and that sort of activity.
And there were dozens of experiments. I mean, what were you busy doing?
Well, every day one of us had to be the guinea pig for a physiological experiment, and that was one where they would we would put ourselves into a tank called a lower body negative pressure device. Mm-hmm. Pull a suction on the lower half of the body and put the heart under stress, trying to pump blood back up to the brain. And we were all instrumented up so that the medical people could see how our heart was responding to that kind of a thing.
Wow.
We also we were on a very, very strict diet because the people on the ground wanted to know how we processed our food. So we were on a very strict diet. We couldn't, we really couldn't move away from that diet at all. And we had to bring back all of the waste body products that were expelled up there in order to allow them to evaluate it and see how we use the nutrients.
Now, and when you're up there, of course, you slowly built up. You basically did a month and 2 months. And, of course, you guys were up there 84 days. And I'm thinking back to when the Mercury guys went first up, and they didn't even know if the eyeball would work in space, let alone the body, you know.
That's right. They weren't sure if you could swallow or whether you'd be able to do any normal bodily functions while you were weightless.
So what was the unknown once you went past 56 days and you started getting on into 60 and 70 and right toward the end of your mission? Was there any concern at that point that there was still some wall out there, some barrier to hit, or were you pretty comfortable the whole time?
Oh, yeah, there was a big concern. That was we were going to run out of food.
Well, that's a big concern. That's a logistics concern, though, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. No other concerns that I can remember.
So were you scrounging around and stashing stuff in secret places by the time you got to the end of the flight?
Yeah, we were doing that. We were also doing things like picking the decals off of our all of our equipment and using it for decorations on our Christmas tree while we were up there.
Well, I wanted to get into that in a minute too, and so you're up there and it's the big holidays coming, and you know, I don't know if you had turkey or what was able still to be in the freeze dryer. I know you had a rudimentary kitchen at the time.
Yeah, we did. Most everything was already cooked for us or prepared for us. We just had to warm it up or keep it chilled if it was ice cream. And the one thing that they did add to us for Christmas Day was a little piece of fruitcake. Other than that, we had to stick to our diet.
And so now I remember there's famous pictures of a Christmas tree, and you talked about the sticker. So what did you do? How did you pull all that together? That wasn't on the flight plan, obviously.
No, that tree was made out of food can liners. All of our foods were in little pop top cans, and they were stored in larger over cans. And they were held into the can with a herringbone kind of a thing made out of aluminum.
Yeah.
So we pulled all those herringbone things out and fastened them together and made a tree, then decorated it with decals from all of our equipment, and that was Christmas.
That's great. And how far ahead of time did you have to plan for that?
Oh, I think we began building our Christmas tree at least a week before Christmas.
At least a week. And, of course, you know, again, Skylab, different from the way we do things now. You didn't have... You mentioned the food. You didn't have resupply missions, so you had to carry it all up in one shot. And I don't imagine a lot could have been saved from the earlier flight, or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, that's right. It was all carried up in the beginning. Some of it, they were afraid, had been ruined by the fact that Skylab had lost part of its insulation there when it was first launched.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought up a lot of extra food with us on the final mission, and we also brought a lot of food bars along. And I guess you can thank Skylab for the development of all of these funny food bars that you could buy these days to boost your protein or boost whatever you want to boost.
And funny is a kind word to use when you describe those bars, isn't it?
Kind word.
Well, take us through. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left before our bottom of the hour break. Colonel, take us through Christmas Day for you in space. What was that day like for you? What was the timeline?
Well, we got up at our normal time. We lived on Houston time, got up at 6 and went to bed at 10 at night. But we got up and began preparations for a spacewalk, which we called the EVA. And two of us went out on the EVA. I was one of them, and we spent about 7 hours, and I think it was 14 minutes or something like that, on an EVA, changing film in all various cameras outside and doing various other experiments. And came back in, and as we took off our spacesuits and got ready for Christmas, the people on the ground told us where to go find our Christmas presents. We ate our dinner, and then that evening we did a Christmas video thing to the ground, talking about our views of the Earth from space in the light of the Christmas season.
Oh, that's great. And what were some of those themes? What were some of the thoughts that you had that you shared?
Well, Ed Gibson had the most cogent one, I thought, when that was, he was the first person to point out that one of the things that came on strongly to us is that you can't see the boundaries that man has put between himself and his fellow man around the earth.
Yeah.
Unless it happens to be a river, and all those boundaries are invisible. It kind of brings home the idea that we're all in this together.
Yeah, that's something. Was the spacewalk, by the way, something that was planned for Christmas Day, or was it just kind of coincidence?
No, it was planned. Yeah, it was very definitely planned, and I had a prepared little presentation that I had worked out with my minister before we left out there in the Webster Presbyterian Church.
What'd you do?
It was just a little statement about the need for humanity to come to understand and respect each other.
Oh, that's neat. That's neat. Well, look, we're going to take a little pause here at this point, and Jeff, when we come back, we'll hear what the story was like from your perspective on the ground as you celebrated Christmas in Clear Lake in the Houston area on that day in 1973. In the meantime, we're going to pause now. Our clocks stop right now for a five-minute built-in hold as we take our bottom-of-the-hour break, get caught up on news, weather, and sports. And when we come back, more with the Carr family. Remember, this is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
Love this music. What's left of Christmas? Christmas starts so early, more and more, September, August, and then it seems like you can't even get through the day and they want to be done with it. I mean, there's not only Christmas specials on Christmas night, it's just before. Okay, well, not, it should be the opposite of Scrooge. Well, anyway, welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Again, you're welcome to call in 321-768-1240. Star 1240 for the AT wireless customers along the Space Coast. Spacetalking at AOL.com by email. Gets your questions right here into the studio. And with us on the phone today from Texas and Vermont, the dynamic father-son duo of Colonel Jerry Carr, commander of Skylab. Well, Colonel Carr, let's talk real quick about this. Do you consider yourself commander of Skylab 4, or was it Skylab 3? I mean, that seems to be no end of conversation in history circles.
Yeah,
as to what to call your flight.
Problem. I call it Skylab 4, really. We started out being Skylab 3 because they were going to call the workshop just the workshop.
Right.
And then the three missions were going to be Roman numeral 1, 2, and 3. And less than a year before the mission started, someone in Washington decided that would confuse the public. So they decided to obfuscate a little bit. And they called Skylab, the workshop, Skylab Arabic 1.
Right.
Then it became 2, 3, and 4. Unfortunately, we had already designed our flight patch.
Your patches, yeah.
It had a big 3 on it.
Yeah, I mean,
no end of confusion.
When I was younger, that just drove me crazy, and I wasn't smart enough to understand Washington mentality yet at that point. But now, when you have STS 10 whatever flying, and it's the 100 and whatever flight, and they don't match up, I guess we're used to it, so... Well, Jeff Carr in Houston, you're listening along to all this, and your father's talking about what it was like that day in Christmas 1973. Give us the perspective from the ground. You know, your dad's going out on EVA. You're sitting there. The presents are ready. I mean, what was your day like?
Well, it was a pretty typical Christmas morning in Houston, Texas, about 80 degrees and muggy. You know,
good. Yeah.
But we were all up at the crack of dawn and raced downstairs and to see what Santa brought, and we did our morning gift exchange and had breakfast. All the time we had what we called the squawk box, which was a little speaker in our living room turned on so we could monitor air to ground between mission control and the crew.
Yeah.
So as Dad and his crew were preparing for the EVA, getting into the suits and getting into the airlock, we could listen along to that when we had, of course, we didn't have the TDRS coverage where we had nonstop air to ground, but we had every 20 minutes or so bursts of 8 to 10 minutes of voice communications that would allow us to keep in touch with what was going on.
Yeah.
And by the time we got breakfast over with, it was time to kind of settle in, and about the same time Dad was egressing the hatch and starting his first spacewalk. And I remember spending most of the day, following along with the day's flight plan and the tracking map and listening to the squawk box.
Now, with your dad having been in space, I mean, it was his first and only flight as commander. He launched, November 16th. You had about a month and change to be used to the idea of your dad being in space and doing that. So was the novelty of that kind of rubbed off? That was kind of standard ops for you at that point?
Well, I think there were a couple of things that conditioned me and my siblings for that. One of them was, being the family of a Marine fighter pilot growing up.
Oh, yeah.
There was another Christmas long before that. I think I must have been in the first grade or something like that when Dad was stationed with his squadron in Japan.
Mm.
And the one phone call we had with Dad from Japan was almost as precious as an air-to-ground phone call that we enjoyed every week or so with Dad while he was in orbit.
Yeah.
The other thing was growing up in the NASA environment down there, and, it was a pretty exciting time back in those days, and the excitement all built and grew around the missions. And from the kids' point of view, we may not know who all the astronauts were and their names were, but we knew who their kids were because you got a certain bit of celebrity status in school when your dad was in space.
Right.
All the teachers made sure that everyone knew who you were, and so living vicariously through my peers in school. You had the opportunity to kind of put your dad in that position and imagine it, and it was very gratifying. It was scary at times. Mm-hmm. There were a few times where you just had to kind of grit your teeth and, believe what they told you, which was that we got the best people in the world supporting us down here on the ground. We're going to be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very gratifying, and that was a fun day to know that my dad was getting his shot to walk in space.
Well, and I think when the general public thinks about at least today's public, their perception of the astronaut family and the kids largely centers around the movie Apollo 13. And so, you're all the perfectly dressed up little boys sitting there on the cover of Life magazine and you don't swear and you don't hurt anybody and everything's great and wonderful and you're proud, happy, and thrilled.
No. They don't call us NASA brats for nothing, Jim.
So, and your friends, you talk about being special during the mission, but the idea of being an astronaut's son or daughter is really no big deal in Clear Lake during that time, was it?
Well, I suppose it was a lot like growing up on a military base, but with, of course, a lot less restrictions. But, a lot of dads and moms worked at NASA.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up there as flight controllers, engineers, trainers, and astronauts. And so we were all relatively conversant with what was going on, at least at my age. I was 15 when Dad flew, sophomore in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, there was not so much, I think rather than a sense of awe or anything like that, there was I always felt like there was a really strong benefit to having grown up in that environment. And I really wish that the kids growing up in and around the Kennedy Space Center and the Johnson Space Center, had the same sort of benefit these days. It was that strong sense of a tie to something bigger than us that was meaningful and was going to make our world better. And above all, I think the kids that grew up with me in that time frame grew up very clear on the notion that nothing is impossible,
mm-hmm.
that you can accomplish anything you set your mind to.
But you had those strong role models to guide you, and I think maybe a lot
Absolutely.
Of times we don't have that now like we used to in a little different time. And, of course, I assume that you talked about your dad being an inspiration. That really led you toward the space program, your second generation space. You caught that passion as early as that, or did it click in later?
I had a passion for the space program from the day that John Glenn flew.
Okay.
I mean, that was a big celebrity moment for our family and for the whole Marine Corps when John Glenn flew. I was just a tyke, but that was pretty exciting. And then a couple of years later when Dad came home and announced he'd been selected, and we were moving to Houston.
Mm-hmm.
I think I knocked on every door on the block and told him my dad's going to be an astronaut, and we're going to Houston. No one believed me at the time, but
right.
probably from, you know, my reputation in the neighborhood. But
right.
It was true, and we were on our way to Houston, and it was pretty heady time.
And your reputation in the neighborhood now pretty much persists, because that's what you basically do, knocking on the door for anyone and everyone that'll hear and talk about space. So,
well, you know, it wasn't something that I really ever considered. You know, I learned at a young age I'd never be a fighter pilot because my eyes were bad and I had to wear glasses.
Yeah.
And I beat myself to a pulp trying to, you know, become a football player and finally realized that wasn't going to happen. So I was forced to finish my college degree and get a real job in my other area of passion, which was television advertising.
Yeah.
And so I graduated from the University of Texas with a radio, television, film degree. And just about a week before I was due to report for my first job at a big time advertising company in Houston, I just stumbled onto a job opportunity at JSC to be a television technical director for the public affairs TV contractor.
Yeah.
And 3 months later, I was sitting in mission control at a console switching downlink TV.
Yeah, yeah, and not too long after that, doing commentary.
That's right. I spent a few hours doing that, too.
Yeah, that was good. So, Colonel Carr, I heard you giggling in the background at one point. This perspective of your son on that day and him growing up, is that all a fair observation, or is he color sugar-coated it a little bit?
I think the astronaut kids provided a lot of entertainment for a lot of people. Jeff and his old buddy, Andy Aldrin. Was it Andy? Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
They entertained during the landing of before the landings for Apollo 11, and he and Andy Aldrin entertained the media outside the Aldrin house by hanging by their knees from a tree out in the front yard.
Good stuff.
Oh, were there reporters there?
And the circus continues, right?
That's right.
I don't think I was invited back after that.
That's great. That's great. Well, so you, did. Jeff, you know, now your father mentioned the downlink later in the day. Did you go into mission control and watch those things? Were you able to do any kind of two-way thing during Skylab?
Yeah, we sure actually both. On Christmas Day, after the EVA was done and they'd had a chance to clean up and eat and prepare for their broadcast, we went into mission control and sat in the VIP viewing room in the back. And so we were there when they did their Christmas downlink, and the picture quality was horrendous.
but
the voices were clear. You could sure pick them out, and that was certainly a Christmas night I'll never forget.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, look, we're going to take our final break. Be back with both Colonel Carr's son Jeff in just a moment or two. Talk a little bit about their thoughts on the future of the space program and where we should be heading. When we come back in just a few seconds on Space Talk on WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock.
Well, welcome back to Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. And as we begin our final segment of, of the year 2009, just a few minutes remaining, Jeff, put your hat on for a second as Director of Communications for United Space Alliance. Give us a sense real quick of what's ahead for this year. We normally do an update with your friend Tracy Yates, but with you online here today, let's talk real quick about what's ahead for USA in the coming weeks and months.
Well, a lot of us have the holidays off, but the space program takes no holiday, as you know. The latest milestone took place this morning at 7 a.m. when Freedom Star arrived at Port Canaveral with the external tank for STS-131 coming up in March.
Oh, very cool.
And that's just, you know, one of a lot of things that are going on. We've got about 75 or 80 employees in Houston that are supporting Mission Control and the International Space Station.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a couple hundred workers at the Kennedy Space Center keeping the facilities maintained and ready for operations, keep maintaining our vehicles and getting ready for a January 7th roll to the launch pad for Endeavour.
Good.
To fly, fingers crossed, on February 7th on STS-130. And, Jim, that puts us on track for 5 final flights of the space shuttle in 2010.
It's going to go by so fast, isn't it?
I really think it is. It's going to be come and gone before folks know it. And I'd be remiss if I didn't remind your viewers, and I'm going to tell a lot of people I told you so in the end.
Mm-hmm.
America's going to miss the space shuttle.
Yeah, absolutely. And Colonel Carr, this is real interesting to me because when you flew Skylab, I mean, we all knew that Apollo-Soyuz was still going to happen in 75, but even at that point in 73, 74, we were facing what we all now call the gap. You were going to finish Apollo and do shuttle, and there was going to be some amount of time where we weren't going to fly in between. I think at that time they didn't realize that it was going to be as long as it was going to be. But I'm wondering if there's anything to learn from that time that we can apply to now.
Well, I think there's a lot to be learned from it. Those who were there at the time realized it was going to be more than just 2 or 3 years. It was going to be like 6 or 7. And so many of us decided to go find something else to do, and I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I just went off and started a different career because I wasn't willing to wait around 6 or 7 more years for another flight.
Yeah.
The same sort of thing is happening here now. I should also say that we lost many, many skilled employees from all of the major companies and from all of the major space stations.
Mm-hmm.
That we lost a lot of talent, people who said, well, I can't hang around here, I don't have a job, so I've got to do something different. So when we were finally back up and running again and we needed those people, most of them said, well, sorry, I've already got a different career.
Yeah.
So we had to retrain everyone, and it looks to me like we're going to be headed for the same thing all over again.
That really seems to lay the foundation for a strong message to the White House and to Congress.
Yes, yeah, there's not only going to be a lot of jobs lost, but once they're lost forever, and when we want to do something else, we're going to have to train people all over again.
Well, and when we do train people and we do get flying again, Colonel, is there any particular thoughts you have about where we ought to go next and with what hardware and perhaps what destination?
I don't know. There's so much political action going on over this thing now. I've kind of lost track over what's the best thing to do. But in my own particular view, I think we need to set our sights for Mars. And how we get there, whether we go to Mars via the moon or whether we use a different system, I guess I really don't care all that much.
Yeah.
But we need to set our sights and get on with it and explore the rest of our solar system.
Well, and Jeff, you know, and you're going to dance the fine line here now as a spokesman for USA, but what can you tell us from your perspective about what's next and maybe what we're planning for, maybe what your personal thoughts are?
Well, my personal thoughts, Jim, is that we need some there out there, i.e., like Dad was saying, a target, a destination, an objective, something that's going to raise the bar for the industry and raise the bar for the program overall.
Mm-hmm.
And give us something to pursue aggressively. You know, we have created something over the last 30 years of flying the space shuttle that that has never existed before. We have the capabilities. We have a seasoned and experienced and talented workforce that uniquely positions us to undertake a new era of exploration in space.
Yeah.
The question is, will we squander this opportunity, or will we put this national asset to work on a new path that challenges our nation and gives us something to look at and aspire to above and beyond the social strife that we tend to get bogged down every day.
And do you think that we can get all of our various segments of the space community talking together, working together from the same page? It seems like White House says we're going to give us $3 billion. What are we going to do with it? And then everyone wants their different thing, different destination, different hardware, and different system, different flavor of the day. Do you think we can get everyone together?
I think it all boils down to leadership and vision. I think if our nation's leaders provide us with a clear vision, and a philosophy for how we achieve that vision, you will see the industry, you'll see the space program get in line to make it happen. Just like it did after President Bush announced the vision for space exploration,
right.
We're able to put our competitive differences aside for a while and focus on those things that we needed to do to enable that vision. The funding never came through
right.
to support that vision, so here we are today. So once we're given that direction and once we're given that charge, we need Washington to provide us the resources that we need to be successful. The program, the contractors, the dedicated, talented people at NASA will find a way to get it done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, hear, hear.
Well, and a good way to end the note and the year on as well, Jeff, because, I mean, I feel exactly the same way you do, that we need that clear vision, we need that clear goal set out for us, and then the team is going to come together and go do that. And I don't think the vision is clear enough yet. I don't think the destination is understood. And I think the squabbling over some of the hardware has just got to stop. We got to move forward. So I agree with you as well. Jeff Carr from Houston, Colonel Carr from Vermont, thank you both for being with us today. And enjoy the rest of your Christmas weekend, and Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's been a real pleasure.
Good. Thanks for both of you. Well, and we say goodbye to them. And also now let's take a look at what we've got coming up here next week, the first program of the new year. I'm going to invite your comments and questions, but I'm going to take a look at the top 10 stories of the space program, that certainly from the perspective of as it affected us along the space coast. And so I'm putting that list together. If you've got some contributions or some suggestions, and you want to send me some email this week at spacetalking@AOL.com, I'll be happy to take your suggestions. In the meantime, I'm going to put my list together, and next week on Space Talk for the first edition of the new year, we are going to debate that and discuss that and give you all the background that you need and see where we go for the next year. So that's it for now. Thanks to all of you for listening today. Don't forget, you can stay in touch with us at WMMBAM.com using keyword Space Talk. Follow us on Twitter at Space Talking. And in the meantime, don't forget that Space Talk is brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB.